A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, July 18, 1982, entitled The Simplicity of Faith in the Gracious God, in the series What the Church Has Forgotten AA Remembers. The text for the sermon is Mark 9, verses 23 and 24. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
The question in focus last week was, who is in charge? Am I in charge, holding desperately to the controls of my life, lest the lid pops off and the bottom drops out? Or have I recognized that I am not in charge, for my life, as a matter of fact, is in the throes of tides and trends and pressures and powers over which I have precious little influence and no control? My life is unmanageable. Until one can say that out of profound conviction, one is not at all ready to enter into any kind of a cure, emotional, spiritual, recovery from alcohol or recovery from any of the other enslavements of our human situation. But once one has come to that point, then the obvious next question is, in response to I need help, is there someone who can help? Is there any hope? Is there anyone to whom I can turn? Is there any power available for the effecting of that human transformation that I have come to see is so necessary in my own life? And that's step two. Step two simply says, we have come to believe in a power beyond ourselves that is able to restore us to health and to sanity. We have come to believe in a power beyond ourselves. No more definition than that. No naming of names or descriptions of natures. Just a power. Call it what you will, a power or a person, an it or a thing, but some power, and I would add, some power that is gracious. For until there is some rising of hope, some spark that is triggered within a person, that gives the possibility of some deliverance from a human condition, there will be a paralysis, a despair, and a sense of futility that will simply keep one bogged down in the mire of one's own desperation. But to the cry, I need help, there must come an openness to the possibility that there is a power that can indeed help, and that that power is gracious. And it is that that is contained in step two, which leads me to the title of this message, The Simplicity of Faith in the Gracious God. Oh, there's a great deal more to come. We are only at step two, and we're still in the matter of diagnosis. There's much more that could be said about faith, and we'll be saying that next week, and there's much more to the whole experience of recovery, but until one has come to the point of acknowledging that his life is unmanageable and has opened himself to the possibility that there is some help, some power beyond himself that can affect the change, there will be no possibility of any kind of transformation of human personality. And AA is just smart enough to recognize that it ought not to load step two with all kinds of baggage, careful definitions, and all sorts of moralizing. For what we are dealing here is still not a moral issue, but a human dilemma. And what is being pointed to is the possibility that there is a gracious power available to those who would open their lives to appropriate it. That is step two, and I believe that once again it is an excellent reflection of the gospel of Jesus Christ. In the story we read a moment ago, there we have it again. a human life situation, a situation of desperation, a situation of crisis, a situation in which a father's heart is broken because of the desperate straits of his child. A child who, I suppose, if we were to try to explain it in modern terms, was suffering from epilepsy. But whatever that may be, and I'm not really interested in that, I am interested simply in the fact that here was a parent with a child whose situation was desperate, a parent who was desperate enough to cry out and say, "I need help, please take pity on me and heal my son." And in that story, we have that which we dealt with at length last week. The perilous nature of human existence. And as I said then, it need not be a dramatic crisis, but on sober reflection, we all have come to see, I'm sure, what a fragile life we live. The problem may be spiritual, the problem may be emotional, the problem may be physical. Business may crash, all of life may come tumbling in around our ears, the bottom may give way. But whatever it is that finally penetrates the defenses we throw up, whatever it is that finally wears thin the facade of respectability that we show to others, whatever it is that unhinges the floodgates by which we keep the raging sea at bay, that is the situation that prepares us to cry out for help. And in that situation, the man came to Jesus with his child, and he said, "If it is possible, have pity on us and help us." And then Jesus showed that he knew the principles of AA long before AA was organized. For he said, "If it is possible, all things are possible if you have faith." And in so doing, I think what he was doing was jogging the man. He was trying to instill that spark of hope. For unless we believe that it is possible, certainly it will be impossible. I don't think Jesus was saying here that faith is some kind of magic mechanism whereby we may, like rubbing a genie, bring anything into reality. But I think he was saying that it is faith, defined as simply an attitude of openness, that is the precondition for the appropriation of the power of God that can transform human personality. It is faith in its minimal form. It is faith which represents little more than the throwing down of one's weapons, the casting down of one's barriers to belief, and the opening of one's mind to a new possibility, to the invasion of a power from beyond, a power beyond ourselves. Define it how you will and explain your relationship to it how you will. Some power that is also gracious. If it is possible, all things are possible to him who has faith. And the Father's response, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief." I love that response. I love it because I use it so often. I love it because I'm sure that of all the exclamations of the Scripture, few have brought more comfort to more people than that simple, "I believe, help thou my unbelief." For does faith ever exist apart from doubt? Does faith live in some impenetrable citadel, never assailed by all of the mystery of life, its suffering? Does faith ever exist immune to all of the acids of unbelief to which we are constantly exposed. I don't know about yours, but I know about mine. Very often, that's about as far as I can go. Lord, I believe. Help thou my unbelief. That minimal response. The simplicity of faith in the gracious God. And Jesus, not concerned to protect the image of the Father or to defend God against some misconception, responded to that minimal faith. For as we read in the story, the child was healed. And I suspect that that minimal faith of the Father that could but say, I believe, help thou my unbelief. Believing against doubt, hoping against all of the fears to the contrary, I suppose that minimal faith blossomed into a full-blown trust in the healing of his son. And AA experiences that too. But you see, AA has a reality check. When one opens oneself to the power, and the power has drying power, one has evidence that there's something to it, that the presence and the power is gracious and effective. But we're not going to go on to that because a full-blown trust cannot come until later. Not even the full-blown commitment of one's life need be dealt with here. It's not involved in step two. Step two accomplishes its purpose if it succeeds simply in prying open the blinders of our mind and planting the spark of hope that there is a power and that that power is gracious. And so we'll go on with that in another week, but let's for a moment linger with step two. And I would make some observations about the question of the existence of God. And my first observation is this: the question of God is not an intellectual question, but an existential question. The question of God is not a question of the mind, but a question of the heart. The question of God is not an academic affair, but a life and death matter. The question of God cannot be isolated into the compartment of the mind and dealt with a cool rationalization. The question of God rages in the restless heart and cries out from the gut for an answer. The question of God, the existence of God, may be intellectually interesting, but it is not serious. If it is simply the intellectual pursuit of an abstract truth, it may be interesting, but it is not serious. It must be the passionate pursuit of the whole person, an urgency born out of crisis and desperation. Then it becomes the involvement of the whole person and whether or not God exists. Now, I've got to make a qualification. Don't understand me to say that the question of God has not to do with our rational faculties. Don't understand me to say that we must not apply all of the best thinking of which we are capable to the question of God's existence. Don't understand me to say that religion is a matter of the heart, some kind of a mystery that can be sheltered under a cloak of piety that need not be exposed to all of the questions that naturally arise in the face of the explosion of knowledge in the modern world and the continuing probing of the secrets and the depths of reality. I do not believe that we may take off our minds. I believe much rather that we must exercise our mind and our heart and our will, the total person, in this question. Faith is not irrational. I would go even so far as to say to believe what is irrational is immoral. And I believe that God would hold us accountable, that God who has created us in His image and given us a mind with which to think, to continue to pursue the question of the truth of the whole of reality and the totality of our lives. But it is still not a question that can be settled simply intellectually through the rationations of the mind of humankind. Probably more than any other person in our day, Hans Küng has wrestled with the question of God's existence. In his book, Does God Exist?, he traces the history of the development of the question of God over the last four centuries. It's a fascinating study. It shows us very clearly where we are today in an environment of modern atheism whose roots go way back to the 17th century. The consequence not of the rise of natural science and the emancipation of the human spirit, but rather of the fearful, unfaithful response of the church in the light of all that has developed in the modern world. But let me ask you for just a moment on a summer Sunday to think with me for just a moment about how that whole process got started. There was a Frenchman named Descartes who was called the father of modern philosophy. Descartes was trying to find a place of absolute intellectual certainty. He began by doubting everything. He doubted systematically everything he had been taught or believed. He doubted everything until he got right down to the circle of his own being, and he said, "At least I know that I am the person who is thinking. I am doubting. Therefore," he said, "I exist." And his famous dictum is, "I think, therefore I exist." Therefore, he was sure of one thing for certain. He had a contemporary named Pascal, a brilliant mathematician, natural scientist, inventive mind, a genius. He said to Descartes, "The human problem is not to find a place of absolute intellectual certainty. The human dilemma is to find existential security." Pascal did not poo-poo the use of the mind, nor did he downplay the exercise of reason. But he is famous for saying, "The heart has reasons, the reason does not know." And he recognized that it was the total person involved in this passionate pursuit of security at an existential level that was the desperate need of the human person. From those two thinkers, the line can be traced throughout the last few centuries concerning the question of God. And as I think Kung demonstrates, the roots of modern atheism lie not because Descartes says we must apply rationality to every question, but rather, the roots of modern atheism lie in the unfaithful, unbelieving, fearful, defensive response of the church to the rise of the modern era, with its application of critical rationality, with its critique of the faith, with its testing of the dogmas, and with its refusal to bow in blind obedience to the traditionalism of the church. The church's fearsome response in the face of the rise of natural science. The church's identifying of itself with the princes and the powers of the established order resulted in the alienation of the church from the thinking community and the alienation of the church from the masses. The question of God, having been subjected to critical examination, did not issue in the modern state of atheism, which is so much a part of our modern world, but much rather, I believe, in the failure of the church to be equal to the task, to think with, in faith, believing in the truth that is rooted in the one true and eternal God. But having said all that, I come back to that first observation, and I think that Kuhn has established that the question of God is not an intellectual matter, it is an existential matter. Finally, what our reason can do is bring us to the point of decision where a choice must be made. A leap into God or into the abyss. And that's really a life and death matter. A life question. Not something that can be thought about in the splendid isolation of the brain with detachment and cool reflection. Well, I have a second observation, and that is that most often the question comes in all of its penetrating poignancy in the situation of crisis. We've said that several times, but I must say it here again. The father came to Jesus because his son was afflicted. And every time the father saw his son in that desperate condition, his heart would bleed. The alcoholic enters the 12-step program when he is convinced that he is in trouble. And so for all of us, most of us, either with great drama or quietly and unassumingly, we come to the point of recognizing our need and cry out for help. Most often, it is a crisis that precipitates the serious wrestling with the question. And you see what that does? That makes religion vulnerable to the charge that it is for the weak. God is good for those who need Him. And of course, the development of modern atheism can be traced along the line of Ludwig Feuerbach, who says that God is simply the result of some need within ourselves that we project out on the screen of reality. God is our projection. He doesn't exist, and so we've created Him because we need Him. Karl Marx says, God is the benefactor of vested interests, and His social criticism of the established powers of the Western world. He saw clearly how church and established power were wed, how the church fawned before the princes, alienating itself from the masses. And so he said, we've got to get rid of God if we would get rid of oppressive regimes. Political revolution demands God off His throne. That's why totalitarianism is atheistic. Communist theory is an economic theory. It has nothing to do with God or not God. Modern totalitarianism is atheistic because only when God was gotten rid of could the traditions that shackled the human spirit be gotten rid of also. Or Sigmund Freud, who said, God is but an infantile projection, an infantile illusion. A child needs a father, even when he's big. That criticism of religion, of the Christian faith, cannot really be defended against. We are vulnerable to that attack. It might be possible for one to say, in full view of the harshness of human existence, the mystery of suffering, the dark shadows that constantly fall across our pathway, it might be one possible for one to say, I am the captain of my soul. I will face it. I will face it. I will face it, bloody but unbowed. Might be possible for one to grit one's teeth, clench one's fist. Highly possible for one to become cynical, bitter, to laugh with scorn at all that is good and true and beautiful. But maybe there's another option. Maybe God has made us for himself, as Augustine said, so that our hearts are restless till they find their rest in him. Maybe he has made us for himself because he loves us. And maybe our fullest realization of that humanness within us can only be realized when it rests in him. Maybe the human being is never more noble and never more human than when the knee is bowed in humble adoration of the one true God who has created and redeemed in Jesus Christ. A.A. would say that's the case. Call it weakness if you will. Maybe it is endemic to the human situation because we have been created to live in relationship with God. But we'll never really be able to defend ourselves against the charge that religion is for the weak. However, I suspect it is for the human. And then a final observation. And that is that all that is necessary is the simplicity of faith in the gracious God. I love this story because that minimal response of the Father, I believe, help thou my unbelief, was all that was necessary to put the child in touch with the healing power of God. The child was healed in response to that stammering expression of faith in the midst of doubt. Because what God is really concerned about is not a careful definition of his attributes and nature. Jesus did not stop to carefully demarcate the conditions upon which that power would be available. Jesus, the reflection of the Father, reached out and touched that human need in response to the most minimal of faith, simply the openness to the possibility of a power that could heal and transform. And the healing and the transformation of human personality begins where there is that minimal openness to whatever power may be, that power that is gracious, Oh, there's a great deal more to say. Much more to come. But this is where it begins. Jesus Christ touching the child is a picture of the power of God that is available to the one who would throw down his arms and cast down the barriers to belief and expose himself to the grace and power of God. That's the good news. Good news indeed. The simplicity of faith in the gracious God. Because we need Him. The church has given us all kinds of reasons to reject Him. But we do live in two worlds. Our experience is a mixed bag. There is wonder and there is the nightmare. For God's sake and for your own, don't miss Him who stands ready to bless. At just the flicker of faith.